Succession number 18822, Reel 11.
At Negorodichye, the Russian customs gave us the works. We put our suitcases onto a large counter, and each of us was given a team of four, three customs officials and somebody armed with a revolver. And they opened my suitcases, took out every article, shook it, and threw it down on the counter until the suitcase was absolutely empty, and then ran their fingers around the inside. And I'd taken school certificate, but I was trying for an exhibition in December, and I'd got some textbooks with me. All the books were taken away, and about an hour later they came back. God knows what the Russians made of them. And we were free to repack our suitcases with our own fair hands. And as we passed through that customs point, we came across two enormous murals. Must have been 30, 40 feet long, 15 foot high or more. 20 foot. One showed happy Russian workers with good farm machinery reaping great sheaves of corn and binding them up. Further along from the reaping, women were binding them up and putting them in. And that was sort of Russia with its natural, making best use of its natural products. And the other was fishing. That was all gold, and the fishing was all silver motif. Great hauls of silver mackerel going aboard, a sort of grey silver coloured ship. And then between them there was a very large notice which said, "The revolution breaks down all barriers." And since we spent about 3 hours standing up, seeing our mechanism, it seemed to be adding insult to injury. Anyway, we got aboard the Russian train, and about a day later reached Moscow fairly early in the morning, and were allowed to use the facilities of the Metropole Hotel, which was really very nice. The Metropole was still in its original condition. You could sort of 1910 architecture decor. One of the restaurant scenes in, of all things, Death in Venice reminded me of the decor of the Metropole Hotel, which is not it was inside and out, it was exactly as it was in 1910 or even earlier. And we managed to get a breakfast and an English-speaking in-tourist, that's what they're called, in-tourist interpreter, took us out to the Red Square, and it was a blazing hot August day. The tarmac was melting in the streets, and we came out of the hotel down and turned into the Red Square, and there, absolutely blazing, was that fantastic basilica of St. Basil. Gold, green, red, yellow, every primary colour blazing away, beautiful condition, a fantastic sight. The colour was so strong in that heat and heavy and sunlight that you almost felt knocked back. And then we were given a terrific privilege. We were taken across the Red Square, and there was a building that looked like a rather superior and large public lavatory, but it was Lenin's tomb, and there was a queue of faithful Russians queuing up for it. But we were just, the interest man flashed a badge, and we were taken straight past. And the Russians showed no indignation or anything at the fact that a party of Brits from going on the Trans-Siberian Express were allowed to go ahead of them. And inside, there were four, not soldiers, there were sailors in full uniform, resting on their arms reversed. Absolutely didn't move a muscle the whole time I was there. And they were at the four corners of a large bed with some covered by glass top on all the sides. And on each corner was one of these sailors, completely fully dressed in some formal or display uniform. And they were carefully, the muzzle of the rifle was on the toe cap, and the rifle was straight up from the ground, and their both arms were there holding it, and they didn't move a muscle while we were there. The discipline was really guards-like. And we looked round. We were allowed to go once round three parts of this, and Lenin was lying on this bed, and there was the most beautiful blanket I've ever seen, done in colours and symbolic embroidery, green and red with me in colours, I remember, but it was looked a lovely piece. It looked lovely on stage, the footlight, I mean, it was just a lovely piece. And Lenin was lying there, you just saw his shoulders and his head, and somehow the head looked enormous, as though he had there, was the recipient of every single good thought about the future prosperity of Russia that could ever be. And the expression of the face was similar. He looked wise, kind, benign, omniscient, and above all, that extraordinary dome of the forehead. But of course we weren't allowed to touch the glass, so go within more than a yard or so of the glass, and we were allowed just round it long enough to go round the bottom of the bed and then out again. And that made quite an impression on me at the time. I think, in retrospect, it was a Tussaud's figure, you know, a wax. I don't think see how they could hold that incredible. I could see that why the Russians queued up, because you just had the feel that at the top of the state had been somebody who'd got things started, who was omniscient, wise, kindly, all-knowing, and so on. After that, it was a bit of a letdown, because we were taken to the Park of Culture and Rest that just looked like a scruffy, dirty bit of ground where the grass had given up an unequal struggle, and we were shown round the various sites of Moscow, and we caught the Trans-Siberian Express to the Siberian frontier. That was quite a long haul. All I could afford was fourth class, also known as hard class. There were four bunks, hardwood, 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 hardwood. And they were at the end of the train. It was first class, dining car, second, third, and fourth. But it only cost me £20 each way to go from Liverpool Street to the Siberian frontier of Manchuria, which was, in fact, for all I know, it took me to Darien. No, perhaps not. I'm not sure, but it was only £20 each way, which was reasonable. And I had been warned, and I had a lilo, so I managed to blow it up, put it on the wooden board. I managed to get a lower bunk, and it was just better than an upper bunk. there wasn't much in the way of facilities. At the end of the corridor, wash basins, but no shower, and a couple of loos. And three times a day, we were allowed to walk almost the entire length of the train to the dining car, where a notice said, breakfast, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., lunch, 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., dinner, 8 p.m. to 3 a.m. So, and as the menu was identical for all three meals, it didn't really matter. Mostly, we had food coupons for three meals a day, and we nearly always got something like borscht, a really good thick soup, so it was a meal in itself. Or there was another soup called Solyanka, which had sour cream on it. But there wasn't much variation, but it was sustaining. And for the next 200 hours, we were aboard this, going through absolutely dead flat country. As far as I was concerned, really devoid of interest, just absolutely flat and featureless. With me in the compartment was a Romanian restaurateur and his wife, who'd been a success in Shanghai and made a profit and shipped all their savings back home to Romania and come by Trans-Siberian Express and then down from Warsaw to Romania. When they got there, they found the chap's brother-in-law had pinched every penny they'd got, and all they could do was just sell what they had, pick up 20 quid each, and go back the way they come and start afresh. And there was nowhere where they could open up a paying restaurant in their hometown in Romania. So I mentioned it simply because they immediately told me the story of their lives as soon as I came into the compartment. And the fourth member of the compartment was a Pole. God knows why he was going. He spoke scarcely a word of English, but every time he saw anything as much as 50 feet high, he would rush in, shake me and say, mountain, mountain. And when we reached the Urals, he nearly went mad. See, being Polish, he'd never seen anything high in his life. Anyway, from that part of Poland, I don't suppose he travelled around much. And with those unlikely companions, I eked out 200 hours eating more than I really needed, because there wasn't much in the way of exercise. Once, three times every 24 hours, for half an hour, the train would stop. I don't know, refueling, water, something. And we were allowed to walk up and down briskly for the time the train was at rest. Warned that get aboard and don't mess around. And above all, don't try and go, what a friend of ours had done on a different trip previously, and it got over couplings in an adjacent train and reached some kind of platform where he bought a cup of Russian tea with a lump of sugar and was enjoying that when he looked round and saw the train was moving. So he ran like mad, but getting over the couplings all that finished, he was lost in the middle of Siberia with his passport, money and everything he possessed on the train heading for the Manchurian frontier. And it took him 3 weeks filling in endless forms and I think possibly in a local jail or something before he managed to get sorted out. So we were warned not to take any risks of any kind. And finally, at long last, we reached the Siberian frontier with Manchukuo. And there, at first, everything was marvellous. The Japan Tourist Bureau board had an agent speaking good English who was very polite and helpful, and there was some slight difficulty. I had to stay the night there, and they tourist man got me a white Russian hotel owner, and the hotel was superb. There was a really decent meal, a comfortable bed, and if you took a cigarette out, a Chinese servant rushed forward and lit a match before you could even get it to your mouth. They were attendant to your slightest whim or need. They really were trying to be good. And at the end of this meal, I strolled out of the hotel just to have a look around the area, and the hotel proprietress, white Russian, rushed out screaming, pulled me back and said, curfew, you mustn't. But I was of that generation of British teenagers who felt that if I would like a stroll in the open air after a decent dinner, I could very well do it and nobody could stop me. But something in her manner persuaded me that it would be best not to. And the next day, I had a slightly disagreeable incident. We were actually aboard the Japanese train going towards Harbin and ultimately to Dairen, and three Japanese private soldiers with rifles walked into my compartment and walked around sniffing and looking at everything they could look at and walked out again. And then an officer came and found my camera just sitting on a table, and there was hell to pay. The Japanese were absolutely paranoid about security, and A, you couldn't even walk 1 yard out of your hotel at night, and B, you're not allowed to have a camera with any film in. Or in fact, you should hand your camera in, it'll be given back to you when you reach Dairen. I explained that three soldiers had come and searched the compartment. They only looked about 15 years old, and they looked as thick as two short planks. And there, lying in the open, visible for them to see, if it hadn't been there looking for hiding places, was my camera, and that explained why it was there. But the Japan Tourist Bureau man spoke on my behalf, and that was accepted. But they ripped out my film, including the film of the Red Square, Lenin's tomb, and so on. When I eventually was some difficulty, one of the difficulties was every time you moved, you were given a great wadge of propaganda about Japan's benevolent and beneficent actions in Manchukuo, turning it from a backward state into an up-to-date country with even a trade balance from exporting their primary produce, all because of the efficiency and competence of the Japanese. And indeed, there was a bureaucracy called the South Manchurian Railway Administration, and they were practically every power that was in Whitehall was in their hands. If you wanted anything, you went to the South Manchurian Railway office, and they dealt, coped, gave you a permit, pass, or didn't, as the case may be. And I got aboard a ship at Dairen and reached Tsingtao, which was a nice holiday resort. A lot of people went up to Tsingtao. It's on the Shantung Peninsula, and within a few miles there are beautiful beaches, one of them so good it was better than Waikiki Beach in Hawaii. And later I saw that this particular village, which is called Pitaho, with the excellent beach, was taken over by Mao Zedong as his holiday resort. But anyway, at the time, there was only one fly in the ointment, the Tsingtao cricket pitch. Wherever the British went, there was always a cricket pitch, and now it's got a nine-hole golf course. The Tsingtao cricket, the Japanese had deliberately quartered their horses on it, ruined the pitch for good and all. And north towards Peking, there had been one or two disagreeable incidents where a local Japanese officer had demanded to strip British people naked on the grounds that he was searching for arms. And what I think the Japanese were doing was seeing how far they could go. You know, quarter your horses on the pitch. If there's no, even if there's a bit of a row, if you get away with it, that's something. Then some British sailors who were obscurely given, at Keelung and Formosa, it's a port called Keelung, and they had been allowed shore leave for, you know, sort of 6 p.m. to 12 p.m., something like that, and they'd done something wrong, got drunk, or anyway, they'd done something that had offended the Japanese, and the Japanese military police really beat them up, smashed all their teeth in. It was a nasty little incident. So all along the line, the Japanese were, I think, in, say, 37, 38, trying to see how far they would go with little incidents, like I've just described. And the only people that stood up, we had Chamberlain, Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister, of course, he was as weak as Ditchwater, absolutely hopeless. And nothing was ever done about any, and even before jeering Chinese crowds, one or two very unfortunate Brits were stripped naked on the pretext searching for arms, and the Japs got away with that. The only people who stood up to the Japs were the French in French Concession. And I once saw, in that holiday of 38, on the French Concession border, a lorry load of a platoon of 30 Japanese troops armed to the teeth. And they came up to the French Concession, and out came a whole series of permits to go through or into French territory for some reason. But a single unarmed enemy's sentry, I suppose you'd call them Vietnamese today, but they were called enemies at the time, just said, stop, the document was not completely in order. And he sent 30 Japs armed to teeth all the way back where they come from to amend the document before they were allowed in. And the French were like that. The Japs never took any liberties with the French. They even, anyway. I had my holiday, met my parents in Shanghai, and on the way back, it was the Munich time. We didn't know it, but Chamberlain was about to get off the plane from Munich and say, "I believe it is peace in our time." But all the way to on the Russian train for 200 hours from Manchukuo to Moscow, there was incomprehensible Russian with the word Czechoslovakia the whole time. The Russian news, which was on the train, was kept on day and night, and the only word I could recognize was Czechoslovakia. And when I tried to get it shut off, they had in charge great blousy fat middle-aged Russian women called babushka. At least that was the word they answered to. And they refused to turn the radio off, and it was as hot as hell. And I tried to get them to open the window just a little bit. They refused point blank. But there was one window, it was just an eighth of an inch open. And the babushka went towards it. I thought, at last, she's going to open a bloody window. Not a bit of it. She just slammed the eighth of an inch shut, turned round, faced me, and laughed. That was sort of Russian bureaucracy on the Trans-Siberian Express. And at Moscow, all the other Europeans jettisoned their tickets from Moscow straight through Warsaw, London, and went at some expense up via Leningrad and Stockholm and back to England that way. And I was the only one that hadn't got the money to do it. paid £20 each way, and my father was reasonably well off, but they were determined, as I said, to get both my brother and I to Oxford, and that they had a massive savings account for that, and we were not prepared to dip into it for anything. So I thought, crumbs, I might spend the whole of the war as a civilian internee in some ghastly German prison camp. But as it happened, everything went swimmingly. We, straight through Berlin, straight through Warsaw, Polish frontier, Berlin. There wasn't even any more any unusual trouble on that Russian Polish frontier stretch of scorched earth and barbed wire and machine guns. And I managed to get to Harwich and sent to my parents three words in a cablegram, delightfully successful trip, to indicate that they had done the right thing, saving money and letting me go clean through. One of some people who were two brothers who were to share my compartment, they were called Hardman. They actually went all the way to Vancouver and across to Canada and the Atlantic rather than risk crossing Germany during the Munich crisis. Anyway, all was well, and we had a year in hand before war really broke out. I'm afraid I never saw Shanghai again. I even refused to go on a trip. You know, one could 4 days in Hong Kong, 4 days in Shanghai, 4 days in Peking, four days looking at those extraordinary clay carvings. It's, one could have done that. My sister, in fact, did do that. But for some reason, I refused. I never saw Shanghai again. War broke out.